camping. So, today I'm going to talk about a chapter in the Denkaroku. So, this is a book written by Keizan, one of our ancestors, Japanese ancestors. So, our first Japanese ancestor who went and studied in China was Dogen, and then there's two teachers, and then there's Keizan. And in Soto Zen, it's said that Dogen is the father of our school, and Keizan is the mother. So Keizan, we have value Keizan as well. The Denkaroku is a collection of stories of each ancestor from Shakyamuni Buddha down through, I think, like Dogen's first student, Koten Ejo. Obviously, it doesn't go past Keizan because he's the one writing the book. So each chapter, it starts with, kind of a koan story, right, of an interaction between the ancestor in question and their teacher. So the first one I've done a talk on before was the Shakyamuni Buddha's story of awakening. And then the second one was his interaction with Makaka Sho and Makaka Sho's awakening, and then a kind of chapter on Makaka Sho. So then this chapter is the next one. This is Ananda studied with Makaka Sho. And the translation that I am reading from, this is Record of the Transmission of Illumination. So Denkaroku, you see it, transmission of light. And this is by T. Griffith Folk. And it's published by the Japanese Soto-shu and the University of Hawaii Press. And I'm not even sure if it's available anymore. And if it is available, it's quite expensive. Because, I mean, the Denkaroku itself is like this. This is one of those ones where like half the page is footnotes. And then there's a companion volume, which is even bigger, which is the glossary. So, this is so precious. I wish this was like $5.99 and you could all have it, right? Because when you're reading these stories and there's something like, there's a jade rabbit in the moon or something like that, in this will be, that will be italicized, and you'll know that you can look that up in the glossary, and it'll tell you like where that phrase or image came from, like the original teaching, and are there any like kind of commonly held understandings about what it means and stuff like that. So anyway, this is a really fun translation to have, but there are many translations of the Denkaroku out there, and they're all good. So I'm just going to kind of read a little and then riff a little and whatever, and we'll see where it goes. So the in each, this is written like a koan story. So there's a case. There's like the little koan is a short case, and then there's like the commentary, or in this case, it's called the investigation. The second ancestor, Venerable Ananda, asked Venerable Kashyapa, "Brother, apart from the world-honored one's transmission of the Kashaya of gold brocade, what is it that is transmitted separately?" Kashyapa called, "Ananda." Ananda answered, "Yes." Kashyapa said, "Topple the flagpole in front of the gate." Ananda greatly awakened. So the Kashaya of gold brocade is the priest's robe. I'm wearing a small version of it, but when I'm in Zazen or I'm doing the ceremony, I'm wearing this, fuller robe. So when you are transmitted by your teacher in Zen, when they are going to acknowledge that you hold and embody the Dharma well enough that you can transmit it to other people, then they give you, or you have to make, then they hand it to you, another robe, a different robe, a different colored robe. So you know, I wore a black robe until I was transmitted, and then we wear either a brown, or, I mean, gold's kind of fancy. So, you know, kind of gold, yellowish, mustardy colored kesa. But of course, I mean, if you're in the line of the Buddha, you get a gold brocade robe, which they probably didn't actually, right? So the kashaya of gold brocade is this sign that that you have been transmitted. And then Keizan's going to go on and describe more, but the gist of this is that Maka Kashyapa had been transmitted, but Ananda had not. So, and then we'll be explaining the top of the flagpole as well. So Keizan says, now this story should be taken as proof that the way of our ancestral teachers is unparalleled by that of other schools. Ananda was already foremost in hearing, having broad learning and great accomplishment. Buddha personally approved him in many ways. Nevertheless, he, Ananda, had not yet received transmission of the true Dharma, nor shed light on the mind ground. All the other, so there's a little story in here where shortly after the Buddha's death, This is. I think of this as mythology. Like, doesn't matter if it's literally true. This is the story we tell. After the Buddha's death, that all the disciples got together to, you know, what is the official teaching? So it was an oral tradition at that point, but they had very precise methods of preserving the oral tradition. So they wanted to essentially establish a canon. Like, what are the legitimate teachings which we should hold and pass on, and I said that Ananda had an eidetic memory, and he was the Buddha's constant companion. So he was like the Buddha's best friend. He went a best friend and assistant and whatever. So he followed, like, throughout the Buddha's teaching career, he never left the Buddha's side. So he heard everything and remembered everything. So all the disciples said, Ananda, as Buddha's servant, has heard much and has broad learning. With him, it is like one vessel full of water being poured into another vessel, without spilling even a little. We would like to ask Ananda to repeat those sermons. Kashyapa said to Ananda, the entire congregation is looking to you. They request you to ascend the seat again and proclaim the teachings. At that time, Ananda guarded that which had been secretly entrusted him by the Tathagata, and accepted Kashyapa's request. He immediately stood, bowed at the feet of the congregation, ascended the seat, and proclaiming, thus have I heard, at one time Buddha dwelt at, and then he recited all the sagely teachings of the Buddha's entire lifetime. Kashyapa addressed the disciples, saying, are there or are there not any deviations from what the Tathagata preached? The disciples said, there is not a single word that deviates from what the Tathagata preached. From this we know for sure that our way does not rely on hearing much, nor does it rely on realizing the fruit of our hardship. So another piece of this is that, according to the mythology, that So Keizan has his own kind of version of the story here, but the older versions of this story are that the only disciples that could be in this little this gathering after the Buddha's death, deciding what should be considered the official teachings, you had to be an arhat. You had to have a level of attainment that meant that you would never be reborn, right? So you had to be a real, like, not just, you know, the knowledge of the teachings, but you had to be a spiritual adept, you know, meditative powers and, you know, all kinds of insight and utter decorum in your behavior and all of that. So you had to also really embody the Buddha's way. And Ananda was not yet an arhat, but like he knew all the teachings and he really wanted to serve in this way. So he just like, all right, so he just went and he worked really hard and he became an arhat, like in time to go. And I think actually the mythology, just because I think it's so cool, was like, well, you know, oh, I think he came and said, okay, now I'm an arhat, you can let me in. And they're like, well, if you're an arhat, then you should manifest your special powers and just get in anyway. So he like made himself really tiny and got into the cave where they were having this gathering. So that means that by the time, so that Ananda then not only just knew all the teachings intellectually, but like practice-wise, he was a great meditator, he was moral, like all of the things that you could think of as being aspects of practice. I mean, he knew everything and he was a perfect practitioner. But the Buddha did not transmit the Dharma to him or acknowledge, you know, that he got it. So we should take this case as proof of this, that our way does not rely on hearing much, nor does it rely on realizing the fruit of our hardship. Although Ananda followed Kashyapa for 20 years, so he was not transmitted by the Buddha, so then he's incredibly dedicated. He just studied with Kashyapa for another 20 years. It was only at the point when this episode took place that he first had a great awakening. In any case, his non-entry into the way of the ancestral teachers is absolutely the same as our own non-entry. Ananda had mastered the sagely teachings of the Buddha's entire lifetime. When, as the Tathagata's disciple, he went to proclaim them, who would not listen to him? Nonetheless, we know that he served and followed Kashyapa. And after his great awakening, he again proclaimed them. Just like fire combining with fire, if you want to clearly investigate the true way, then discarding your own views, old feelings, pride, and arrogance, you must turn back to your beginner's mind and unite with Buddha awareness. In the aforementioned episode, Ananda had long thought that the Kashaya of gold brocade was transmitted, that Kashyapa was a disciple of the Buddha, and that there was nothing else to it. Nevertheless, after following and intimately serving Kashyapa, he also thought there was something more to penetrate. When Kashyapa knew the time was right, he called Ananda. Just like the rising of an echo following a call to the valley spirit, Ananda responded immediately. It was like a spark leaping from flintstone. Although he called Ananda, he was not calling to Ananda, nor was the reply that of a responding echo. Topple the flagpole in front of the gate refers to a procedure in Western lands whereby whenever disciples of Buddha are, as well as followers of other paths, debated, both sides erected flags, and whichever side lost thereupon tore down their flag. When they lost, that signaled the loss without sounding a drum or bell. In the aforementioned episode too, it is as if Kashyapa and Ananda squared off and erected flags. At that point, if Ananda had already come into his own, Kashyapa would have had to fold up his flag. But that is not how this episode goes. Kashyapa is a flagpole, and Ananda is also a flagpole. But if we were to suppose that they are flagpoles, then the principle of this episode is unlikely to be evident. When the flagpole is once toppled, the flagpole should indeed be evident. When Kashyapa indicated topple the flagpole in front of the gate, Ananda, by penetrating the way of master and disciple, had a great awakening as soon as the words were finished. After his great awakening, Kashyapa too was toppled, and the mountains and rivers all crumbled. As a result of this, Buddha's robe spontaneously arrived atop Ananda's head. So, what is it that some people have? We witness something in the way that they express themselves or act, speak, behave, even if we don't meet them personally, right? In a sense, we can encounter people through teachings or through stories of their actions as well. But in person, we see the way they move and speak and behave. And we're inspired to get something of what they have. We gravitate toward them, studying their words, asking for instruction. The way of the student can be long and at times frustrating. We may consider giving up. When our fellow students seem to advance more quickly than we do not understand why. What are they getting that we do not? Although we receive the same instructions as everyone else, something within us seems to obstruct us, to limit us. And this is true, not just in like practice, Zen practice or Buddhist practice, but in like any discipline you can think of. There is some indescribable element with thinking je ne sais quoi, I don't know what, right? That you know, here's somebody, here's a student, here's somebody learning and trying, then the apprentice, and then somebody who has mastery. Oh, whatever it is, like, what is it? What is this mystical element? Striving, effort, enthusiasm, determination, focus, love, passion, surrender, but we can try to like summon all of these things, pour all of these things in, and still not quite have it. This je ne sais quoi will not be tamed or captured or commodified. What is remarkable about Ananda is that he does not give up. Would you be willing to practice diligently for 40 years, all the while being told in so many words that you're missing the fundamental point? Not only that, like you study for 20 years and your fellow student, they get the point. And then you go, okay, fine, I'll study with them. You know, that is determination and great humility. So I was thinking that Ananda, you know, if I'm sure this metaphor, this comparison analogy is only take us so far and fall apart. But it's kind of like the ugly duckling, right? The swan born into the duck family who cannot fit in. He's ungainly, he doesn't look the way he should, doesn't move the way he should, and everybody makes fun of him, right? Except Ananda, like us, is a swan who has subsequently left the duck family, because somebody tells him, like, oh no, you know, the problem is you're actually a swan. Oh, okay. So then he goes out to find a swan family. And then he's like, he's studying, really studying what it means to be a swan. You know, they're supposed to move this way, supposed to do this way, okay. So you're learning all the stuff that you're supposed to know and do if you're a swan. But he's not, you know, in the story, the swan sees his reflection in the water and realizes, oh, I'm a swan. But let's say we don't see that reflection, right? Somebody tells us we're a spawn, but we're still, in our minds, all we think of is ourselves, you know, how we should, we think we should look like. We're an awkward duckling. So for years and years, Ananda the Swan studies the ways of the swan, mastering every detail. No one knows more about swan ways than he does, and yet truly being a swan eludes him. Frustrated, he finally asks a wise old swan, "What am I missing? What else is there?" And the old swan looks at Ananda compassionately, saying, "Ananda, you know, no more effort is needed. What? Give up your effort." This does not mean you should give up your Zen practice and study. Without it, we can't get to that place of vulnerability and openness, right? That ripeness that is required for us to realize our true nature. So Ananda the Swan, at that pivotal moment, just like it all just like comes into focus. Like that, those things that you stare at with the random patterns, and then they coalesce into what looks like a three-dimensional thing. And I'm sorry for those of you whose eyes don't work that way. that analogy is not useful for you, but you know, you look at it long enough, and somehow, just without trying to control it, your eyes focus in a different way, have a different focal length, and this picture comes apparent. So I picture Ananda, you know, suddenly just, I've manifested, I am a swan, like, and I have been all along. Such a realization has been sneaking up behind him for a long time. At the last moment, it's not far away. Right? So we're like, we're priming ourselves toward this so that it's not like, you know, some kind of amazing, transcendent, otherworldly vision comes to you. It's more just like the last piece of the puzzle just slips into place. Oh. So Kazon tells us Ananda's story with great reverence and tenderness. What is so significant about Ananda's story that it has been passed through the millennia to us? It's about the nature of the awakening that is truly liberating. So there's many insights we can have. There's many aspects of our practice. From the beginning to the end, it is useful and helpful. Just basic mindfulness, just sitting down to meditate, following the precepts, it working with our karma. There's all kinds of things that are beneficial, but at the core down there is like awakening to our true nature. It's the most transformative. So we may, you know, engage all these other aspects of practice, but if we fail to recognize our true nature, what a shame. What a shame to be a swan wandering around thinking it's actually a duck, not realizing its true nature. Such healing, such freedom, coming home, joining the family of all sentient beings, the family of all beings, belonging, intimacy, knowing who we truly are. But inevitably, we imagine that recognizing our true nature is dependent on the acquisition of another piece of knowledge, understanding, or skill. I mean, that's just that's how everything else works. Why doesn't it work like this? Like, you know, emptiness. Okay, we get to discussing emptiness. I'm like, well, you know, at some point, maybe in the future, like, you know, I'll get an understanding. That's what emptiness is. That it's just, you know, in our nature to think like that. Or some skill, right? Maybe it's not understanding, but it's, It's the way that we behave or practice or meditate or something, that some additional thing is going to be what, like, okay, and then we awaken to this the fundamental point. But the Ananda story tells us this isn't the case, right? Because Ananda, every last, and let's say he did not just, it's not just like he was repeating like a parrot, like he understood. And he had been, you know, right next to the Buddha, so he understood all of the teachings. I mean, no Buddhist teacher I know could possibly say that, I know all the teachings, right? He knew every teaching, and he practiced impeccably. So what is this realization? That's where I like the image of realizing you're a swan when you've always thought you were an ugly duckling, right? It's that kind of realignment of your whole perception of yourself in relation to the universe. That is this awakening to our true nature. So I guess I'll just leave it there. Questions and comments, James.
There's another version of that story that I learned. I don't remember where I got it or where it came from, probably some place pre-Zen, that when they were organizing the council, Makakasha was organizing the council of all the arhats to discuss the Buddhist teachings, and it was the same situation. Ananda, well, sorry, Ananda, you're not an arhat, so you're not invited. And Ananda said, okay, I am going to awaken before this council takes place. I am going to get in. I'm going to be in there. And so he worked really hard day and night. It just buckled down and she concentrated and tried to obtain awakening. And as the hour approached, he said, well, I'm not awakened yet. It just didn't happen. Man, okay, well, so I guess I'll get some rest. And the minute his head hit the pillow, he awakened. And so that, and I think there's, I mean, parallels, obviously, to this story in that one. But I love that idea, because the idea is the same, that the minute he stopped trying, you know, not that he shouldn't have put forth effort, but it was that moment where he just let go of all of the striving and just let things be the way that they were. That was that moment that he popped through. And like the counterpoint to how, like, the story of the Buddha's awakening, you know, it could be a little discouraging because it's kind of that opposite mindset. Like, he sat under that tree day and night and he didn't move.
He said, I'm not going to get up until my bones, you know, disintegrate.
Yeah, exactly right. You're like, oh man, when am I ever going to be able to do that? Like, that's not going to happen in my life. So I appreciate the story of Ananda for that same reason that you mentioned. It's just like, just keep plugging away. You know, awakening will happen when you least expect it, probably. So I appreciate the story. Thank you.
Well, that's what I like about the, there's an aspect to that, topple the flagpole. Now, we not 100% on the meaning and significance, but I think, because I don't think anybody really knows back in India, like, what are the, you know, how they use these flags or whatever, but it seems to me like you, if there's a flagpole, that you would somehow raise a flag on it, right? So it's not just take down your flag. It's not just like you've been defeated. It's like get rid of the whole flagpole, right? Sometimes the translations are chop down the flagpole, like, and yet that whole koan of effort versus the letting go, because inevitably, I mean, I as well would just be like, well, if that's the case, then let's shortcut all of this annoying effort and struggle and just get to the light, because really it's just about letting go. I mean, Ananda woke up when he's doing his head hit the pillow, you know, so let's just look, it's just rest. And yet that's not, And that's not it either, right? And I feel like that is what takes the only thing you really need to awaken is great determination and refusal to give up. Now, I'm just not saying how long it'll take, but that's all, you just have to survive and not get frustrated and give up. And I feel like I somehow was blessed with a mix of stubbornness. I needed my teacher's approval, not in like a, you know, weird parental way like that, but like until I could go to her and she would say, you know, like, essentially give me transmission. Not that I wasn't really looking for transmission, but I was looking for her to say, yes, you got it, right? You got it. And until she said, I got it, I couldn't leave. I'm just like, damn, you know? Like a part of me would be resentful about it and everything, but until she said, I got it, there's some part of me that just was too stubborn to give up. And at a certain point, it felt like I was just hitting my head against a brick wall repeatedly with no obvious progress until I just reached a point of like, just, you know, it's like that desperation, exactly like Ananda, right? Like giving. Because as if we just went home and put our and laid our heads on the pillow, there'd be part of us would be thinking, well, there's a lot of things I could try, but I'm just not going to bother. But when you feel like you have tried I've tried everything, I've given it everything. The surrender that comes after that is what this is. It's like, why do you have to beat your head against the wall first? I don't know. It's just the way it is. Jessica.
So when I heard the part in the story about topple the flagpole in front of the gateway, what I heard was let go of that small self, let go of those machinations and constructs of the aggregates, and the gateway will open. Hmm. And that seems akin to what you just said about surrender. And I wonder if you have a thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you might say that this particular goal, you know, is not something that's attained by the small self, right? And yet we're like, well, who else is going to attain it? That's like the only thing that we know. So in a way, that's what, you know, at some point forces us to, I don't know, reach into a different part of ourselves, or I don't know, be in a different way, because we recognize like this small self has tried everything. And I think that's where kind of it seems really weird that Buddhism, which is basically rational and is about, you know, us working on ourselves, and you might look at it as like a philosophy or a lifestyle, and you know, it's very pragmatic, that it ends up with kind of a devotional element. But I think it's, you know, it's about meeting that place where, what is it that takes over? What is it that just for certain moments, when I am playing music, the small self is getting out of the way and something is happening. Now, my fingers know how to move because the small self practiced, but then at some point that small self gets out of the way and it's, what is that? Who is that? I'm not making that up. Like, it's just moving through. Julia.
I love this discussion and this story. You know, it was when you were talking about the various ways to translate topple the flag, when you said chop down the flag, what occurred to me was Ananda, this is not a competition. Stop fighting. You know, say you have this eidetic memory, you have a gift. It doesn't mean you're better than everybody else. It doesn't mean you deserve more than everybody else, you know? And I think, and it just occurred to me as I sat down here in this chair, it was like letting the small self just get out of the way. That's all.
And it is the different people have different stories, and we probably all have actually both stories. So some people might have a story like, I'm not up to this. This kind of realization or whatever is just not in my ballywick. So I'll just kind of, you know, in one ear and out the other, because that's not for me. And there's others of us who are like, mm-hmm, yeah. Might take a while, but I got what it takes. You know, like, but I don't think any of us like get to dwell in just entirely in one story. You know, I might, because then I'm beating my head against the wall, and I'm all of a sudden that story about my competence just starts to, you know, disintegrate. So the story of being able to do it or not being able to do it, or having what it takes or not having what it takes, is kind of like, that, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but several of our chants and readings say like it has, I don't know, intelligence or lack of it is not an issue. It's not. It's just not relevant. Our skills are you know, so that sometimes, you know, people might be impressed when I or, you know, somebody else who's offering a class or talk, and, you know, they have lots of fancy words and they remember the teachings and they can refer to this and that, and, you know, wow, you know, they're so knowledgeable about Zen. But it's kind of like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but it also is not, it's not the key to anything. Denny.
First of all, I really appreciate what both Jessica and Jinryu said. And listening to this, it reminded me of a chapter from Suzuki Roshi's Not Always So. And at the top, underneath the title of the chapter, because we always pull out a line or two underneath each chapter, if you have a copy, well, just in case you have a copy, it's on page 16. It's called Jumping Off the 100-Foot Pole. Because I thought of that pole as, or thought of Ananda thinking of it as, once the flag reached the top of his up the pole, it was like he could pin a medal on his shirt, and he'd all of a sudden be something different, something better. And if it's okay, I'll quickly read just a couple of paragraphs. Whatever you call it, that is another name of reality. Even though you call it a mountain, oh, I'm sorry. In the same way, some people may think that lay people and priests are fundamentally different, but actually there is no particular person who is a priest. Each one of you could be a priest, and I could be a lay person. Because I wear a robe, I am a priest, and I behave like a priest. That's all. There is no innate nature, as he's talking throughout hear about Buddha nature. There is no innate nature that distinguishes priest from layperson. That is the problem. So forget all about stopping at the top of the pole. To forget about the pole is to be where you are right now, not to be this way or that way, not to be in the past or the future, but to be right here in your own nature. Do you understand? This is Shikantaza. So the secret is just to say yes and jump off from here. Then there is no problem. It means to be yourself, always yourself, without sticking to an old self or trying to be a new self.
Cedar.
I think I was mainly thinking about the story of the swan and how we as different cultures try to strive for particular ideals. But really, we have our own way of being in the world, which is not going to be like the duck or the swan. And like the arhat finding its own way in. We have our own gifts and our own ways of brilliance within us to explore for ourselves and to discover for ourselves versus just following somebody's way.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where, like, exactly there, then that's where the analogy, like, breaks down, right? Because we're not even trying to become like any group, right? Fulfill any ideal. So, like, essentially, you know, it's not like, look, you really are a swan. It's like, look, you really are you. You're like, perfectly you. Which is like, duh, but somehow we imagine it to be otherwise. So there was a one paragraph at the end of this that I didn't read because we had plenty to discuss, but I have a few minutes now, so I'll so this is after, you know, so the Buddha's robe spontaneously appears on top of Ananda's head. However, do not use this episode to stop with. Now, this is one of those italicized phrases that means something. Do not stop with, upon this lump of red meat, a cliff rising 1,000 fathoms. So. Upon this lump of red meat, a cliff rising 1,000 fathoms. So he says where it originates. But then the expression lump of red meat refers to the human body. The expression cliff rising 1,000 fathoms is a metaphor in this context for the Buddha nature or Buddha mind, which is the life principle present in all living beings. It is simply there at all times, as unavoidable and awesome in its presence as a cliff that towers 1,000 fathoms, roughly 8,000 feet, in front of one. However, it is essentially formless and signless and cannot be grasped through language, just as a sheer cliff provides no handholds or footholds with which to climb it. That was cool. So, so as profound as that is, like, upon this lump of red meat, a cliff rising 1,000 fathoms, like, right here, in on whatever, this human body, this, like, obvious Buddha nature, you know, if it was a snake, it would have bit you, kind of like right there it is. So as profound as that is, Kazon saying, do not use this story of Ananda to stop with upon this lump of red meat, a cliff rising 1,000 fathoms. Do not stop at cleanliness. You must, by advancing, know the existence of the valley spirit. The valley spirit being yet another metaphor for our true nature. When the Buddhas appear in the world for time, what the Buddhas appear in the world for time after time is what the ancestral teachers indicate generation after generation is only this matter. Using mind to transmit mind, after all, is not something known to people. So using mind to transmit mind. So the transmission of mind, so this is language that is used to talk about that transmission between you know, flesh and blood teacher and student to flesh and blood student. The trope of the transmission of mind is conceptually problematic because according to the Mahayana scriptures, the Buddha mind is innate in all living beings. It is not an external object or thing that can be handed down from one person to another. Unlike the Buddha Dharma that is preserved in scriptures, moreover, the mind Dharma of the Chan or Zen lineage is by definition inconceivable and ineffable. Thus, the mechanics of the transmission of mind from master to disciple is explained by likening it to various forms of nonverbal interaction, such as communicating by mental telepathy, transmission of mind by means of mind, or using the flame of one's own lamp to light another person's, or stamping a piece of paper with an official seal verifying a contract, or stimulus and response, such as that which takes place when one bell is struck and another bell nearby. Begins to resonate sympathetically. In the final analysis, the literature of Chan or Zen makes clear all a master can do is model the awakened state of mind through speech and gesture, and to try to cajole or shock students into verifying their own innate Buddha mind. So I thought that was just an amazingly rich image. They're not saying that this transmission happens through mental telepathy, but they use this imagery because it is so, like, what is it? It is just, it is something that can be mutually recognized. That's another saying is Buddha recognizes Buddha, right? Between two people who recognize, you know, oh, you get it. You know, you're not getting anything special except for I have embraced my Buddha nature and I can see yours shining through as well. So we have a few minutes left. Additional thoughts? I'll finish by reading the rest of the final bits of that chapter then. If we suppose that lumps of red meat have come forth, Kashyapa and Ananda included, that are appearances in the world of one face or two faces of that person. So this is a italicized that person. Once again, we're pointing toward this true nature, that person. So we must not take Kashyapa or Ananda as that person. So I'm taking this to mean, like, if we think of this as, okay, there's this, I don't know, this grand nature out there, and has appeared as Kashapa and appeared as Ananda. That this isn't quite right either. All of you people now, each a cliff rising 1,000 fathoms, are but the 1,000 variations and million transformations of that person. If you gained consciousness of that person, then you would bury people at the same time. Bury people at the same time. So it's a famous koan about it. Okay. So one day there was a monk who entered the Dharma hall weeping and wailing. The master Baizhang said, "What is it?" The monk said, "I have lost both my father and mother. Please, master, select a day for the funeral." The master said, "Tomorrow, let us bury them at the same time." He says, in this context, bury has a double meaning. The first, of course, is to bury the dead. But Baizhang's statement cannot be taken literally, for funerary practices in China at the time did not allow for immediate burial of the dead or for joint funerals. Understood figuratively, Baizhang may have been urging the bereaved monk to look past the superficial arising and ceasing of phenomena, in this case the life and death of his parents, to see the underlying Buddha nature. So if you gained consciousness of that person, then you would bury people at the same time. If that were the case, you would certainly not be looking outside yourselves for toppling the flagpole. Anything else? We've got 2 minutes. Leave it with those sweet words. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, Jamia. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. It was really lovely.
Bye.